Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is August 6th, 2017, and this is episode 143, Splatoon! Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're a kid now, and we're a squid now. But first, our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy, take it away.
Yeah, a follow-up on Dynasty Warrior 9. Sorry, Dynasty Warriors 9. There are many Warriors. I'm right up into the 80s, in fact.
Nope, only one.
Dynasty Warrior. So Dynasty Warriors 9 will actually be coming to the West on PS4, Xbox One, and PC. This is notable because it's only a PS4 release in Japan. So I guess that doesn't really surprise me because it's a pretty popular franchise over here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised about this. Obviously, there would be no point in doing a Japanese release of the Xbox One version.
That's true.
I am a little surprised that they're not also getting a PC release over there, but at the same time, it might just be one of those things where we hear about it at a later date.
That's true. And, yeah, so that will be coming at some point. We still don't really know a release window from all of the research I have done. But, you know, it's got the open world gameplay, so it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Excellent, excellent. We also have gigantic news here regarding the .hack GU Last Recode HD remaster. In addition to the three volumes of .hack GU that were released on the PlayStation 2 originally, this is also going to have an all-new Volume 4. And this isn't just going to be a small piece of game as far as we understand. It's actually going to be treated as an entire episode all its own. It's going to have new battle forms. It's going to have new characters. It really looks like this is going to be an enormous addition to the .hack GU series.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really exciting. So I would expect to hear a lot more information about that. It's actually going to be releasing in Japan on November 1st. So that's not too far off.
Oh, boy.
Bizarrely, it feels like the year just started in some ways. So we also have a bunch of release news updates here for you. The first one is that this week, the Nintendo eShop for the Nintendo Switch is going to be getting King of Fighters 2000. King of Fighters 2000 is one of the more well-known games in the series. It's the first one that brought the active striker system into play. You know, has really beautiful artwork and everything. So definitely a release I'm very excited about. We also have news here that Mary Skelter Nightmares will be releasing on the PS Vita in North America on September 19th.
What?
Yeah, we're actually getting Mary Skelter here in North America.
On the Vita. Wow.
Yeah. DJ Max Respect will be releasing in Japan on November 9th for PS4.
Oh, I bet Shane is super excited about that.
He actually made a Hong Kong account in order to download it already, because it's already out there.
Oh, that's right. I remember him tweeting about that.
We also
it was just like a demo or something.
We also have word that Rhyme will be releasing on the Switch in November. Yo-Kai Watch 2 Psychic Spectres will be releasing on 3DS in North America on September 29th. Monster Hunter Stories will be releasing on the 3DS on September 8th. Rayman Legends Definitive Edition will be releasing on the Nintendo Switch on September 12th. And last but certainly not least, Lost Sphere, which is the upcoming JRPG from Tokyo RPG Factory, will be releasing on Switch and PS4 on January 23rd, 2018.
Unless it's delayed. Which I guess you could say for every game that we ever talk about in release dates.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, I suppose. It feels a little bit like you're picking on Square Enix, but again, you know, as we discussed last week, I think people give Square Enix an unfair rap these days.
Well, you know, Final Fantasy XII's Zodiac Edition brings back some memories of having to wait for that game.
Oh, yeah, no, and you know, I am very sympathetic. You know, I hate when games are delayed when I'm super excited for them. But, you know, by the same token, I think it's reasonable to expect that they're doing their best.
Oh, yeah, I'm just being petty.
Fair enough. It must come easy to you because you do it a lot.
Yep.
All right. Well, with all that having been said and done, let's talk some news.
News. Oh my God. News. All right. So Dragon Quest Builders 2 has been announced for PS4 and Switch.
What?
Yeah, this was announced during the Dragon Quest Summer Festival 2017 event that just took place.
Yeah, that was actually like this weekend in Japan.
Yeah, prepare yourself for a lot of Dragon Quest news over the next few minutes.
That's kind of my favorite kind. Really excited, of course, about this Dragon Quest Builders 2 news, though. As I saw a lot of people online remarking, it's kind of a big deal, a little bit of a sea change represented here, that this is going to be a Switch and PS4 game rather than a Vita and PS4 game.
Well, I'm kind of not surprised, because isn't Minecraft doing really well in Japan on Switch?
I mean, Minecraft does really well in Japan on any platform it releases. It was still a top seller on the Vita as well. I mean,
like, I feel like I was reading on Twitter or something that there's a Nintendo of Japan YouTube feature that they have where Arino-san is playing Minecraft. And I guess they release it every so often or whatever. And it had more views than the Mario Odyssey trailer or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this is exciting. I didn't get around to Dragon Quest Builders 1 yet, but I'm glad that it did well enough that people want more.
Well, and you know, that's a big part of why I'm really excited about this, is I played that first Dragon Quest Builders game, and I liked it a lot. And my biggest problem is that I was playing it on PS4, and I would have preferred to have been able to have taken it on the go, but I didn't want to buy a second copy for Vita just to play on my commute or whatever. So having it on Switch for me will be kind of the perfect combination. And as I recall, Dragon Quest Builders sold better than most of the mainline games sell here. So I'm very confident that we will get Builders 2 here.
Well, I hope that doesn't mean bad news for the rest of the Dragon Quest games that we are talking about in this new segment, including Dragon Quest Rivals, which is going to be a fall smartphone launch, and then eventually will come to PC. It is looking to be kind of a Hearthstone, but with a Dragon Quest sort of theming, and featuring characters from Dragon Quest 10 and 11.
Ooh, this is
probably
exciting.
Other ones, but you know, those are the ones that were featured.
Yeah, I actually think this is exciting, and this is the kind of game where even if North American gamers maybe won't recognize the characters, if the gameplay is decided to be strong enough, I could still imagine them releasing it here. I'm just going to start crossing my fingers now.
Yeah.
We also have word that Dragon Quest XI will be releasing in North America.
Oh, good.
It's going to be coming in 2018, and it has the fantastic title of Dragon Quest XI: Echoes of an Elusive Age.
Oh, Dragon Quest.
We don't yet know if we're going to be getting the PS4 and 3DS and Switch versions. We actually don't know anything other than we will definitely be getting the PS4 version. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that we get them all. The PS4 version is kind of the only one I'd prefer to skip, so fingers crossed.
We also have Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy's 30th anniversary I can't even say that. Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy's 30th anniversary Fortune Street, which will be coming October 19th in Japan. This is not the first time that Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy have had a crossover on Fortune Street, but I look forward to it. I don't know if we'll get it over here.
Yeah, I would really love to see this release here. Did you watch the main trailer for this release? It's really quite fantastic. It basically is like a Kingdom Hearts trailer, but instead of everybody like looking for hearts and like the power of friendship, it's all about greed and money.
Aww.
Yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. I'm super excited for it. Hopefully it will release in North America, but if it doesn't, this is probably one I would import.
Excellent.
We also have word here that Dragon Quest 1, 2, and 3 will be releasing, at least in Japan, on the PS4 and 3DS. This is very exciting. You know, with this announcement, once Dragon Quest 3 releases, all of the Dragon Quest series will be playable on the 3DS family of consoles, which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, you know, it's one of Japan's most beloved series, and for it to remain accessible into the modern day is, I think, a really fantastic thing. Dragon Quest 1 is going to be releasing on August 10th for 600 yen on PS4 and 3DS. Dragon Quest 2 will release the same day for 850 yen on PS4 and 3DS. And Dragon Quest 3 will be releasing also sometime in August, but they did not give a specific release date, and that's going to be 1,500 yen. Very exciting news. Early word is that these are based on the actually really good mobile ports that the early Dragon Quest games have gotten.
Wait, good mobile ports?
Dragon Quest 1 is available in Dragon Quest 11 as an unlockable, and it is a mobile port kind of standalone experience with its own trophy set and everything. So
that's cute.
Quite a few fans are assuming that this is going to be just a separately packaged version of that port.
Maybe whoever works on the mobile ports of the Dragon Quest games can start working on mobile ports of Final Fantasy games, because those tend to be terrible.
Nah, they've already got mobile ports. But we also have word on Dragon Quest X's next expansion. This is going to be released in November on the 16th, specifically for PS4, Switch, Wii U, and PC. This is the 5,000-year journey to the distant homeland online. It looks very cool. Obviously, you know, I'm a big fan of Dragon Quest X's aesthetic and everything. We've talked about it a lot over the years here. Something I think is really cool is that it's actually just launching at a price point of like 3,800 yen, which is, you know, under 50 or under 40 US dollars.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool. I remain optimistic that maybe someday we'll get this released here, but
I was going to say
my faith is beginning to run dry.
It's starting to feel like a 5,000 year journey to this getting localized.
Right. We also have word that there will be an early access demo for Dragon Quest X on PS4 that will basically be effective for Dragon Quest XI players once the early access demo kicks off on August 10th. So just later this week. We also have word here that Dragon Quest XI has surpassed the 3 million units sold mark in Japan. That is, of course, both in terms of physical copies and digital copies, and combining the PS4 release and the 3DS release. But that's a lot.
Yeah.
So I think that's enough Dragon Quest news. Saiki, do you have something else for us?
Sure. We have Phantom Trigger, which is described as a neon slasher from Tiny Build Games and Bread Team. Those are both really cute studio names. This is described as an RPG and roguelike, which follows the main character Stan, whose ordinary life is turned upside down by a certain mysterious event, which leads to him having to explore surreal demonic worlds with a rich combo system, upgradable weapons, and story-driven levels. So this is going to be for PC and Switch on August 10th for $14.99. What do you think of this?
You know, I'm really looking forward to playing this game. I've seen a lot of people online compare it to Hyper Light Drifter,
More demonic.
Well, but my understanding is that while it does share a similar basic aesthetic, although as Saiki notes, definitely very like you're a ninja in hell thing going on here with Phantom Trigger. My understanding is that the gameplay is also a little bit more like Diablo-like in terms of like having loot and gear that upgrades and stuff, and you know, having a real focus on like combos and stuff rather than just, oh, this is a 2D Dark Souls game with a minimalistic aesthetic.
Yeah. Let
me be clear, there's no shade there. Like, Hyper Light Drifter is rad. I love it. I own multiple copies on multiple platforms. But, you know, I also don't think that an aesthetic needs to be tied to one game alone. And I'm excited to see if Phantom Trigger is any good.
Maybe you'll be a Stan for Stan.
Ah, maybe. We also have a little bundle of Persona news, the first of which, of course, is the sequel to everybody's favorite Persona game. Do you know what game that is, Slaggy?
Persona 4 Arena?
Close. Persona 4 Dancing All Night.
Okay, that game actually is great.
Yeah, right? We're actually getting two sequels. One is Persona 3 Dancing Moon Knight, and the other is Persona 5 Dancing Star Knight. So this is, of course, very exciting. I'm a big fan of the Persona Dancing All Night for P4. Very excited to see versions of this sub-series for Persona 3 and 5, because both have fantastic music.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, I'm actually really trying to motivate myself to getting back into Persona 5, but really struggling. But I'm 100% sure I'm going to jump right the hell in on Persona 5 Dancing Star Knight.
Yeah, because they'll just be dancing and hopefully not having problematic encounters.
Right. Pretty much, though. Definitely excited. Little bummed, though. It's going to be these games are going to be releasing on PS4 and PS Vita. You know, I'll buy them, in this case, probably on Vita. Hopefully they're Vita TV compatible, so I can, you know, hear that beautiful music through my sound system. But still a little bummed, no Switch version, just because it would be so much easier.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you think? You're going to pick either of these up when they release in spring of 2018?
Of course, but I'm just laughing at the fact that you have a Vita TV.
This from the person who I literally know for fact was super salty when he was unable to get a PS TV cheap off of Amazon.
That did happen. I was about to just mention that. Well, thankfully,
bum, 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 bum,
bum. Thankfully, the next piece of news does not have to do with a Vita TV. It is a teaser image of Persona Q2 with the imagery of Take Your Heart. So,
Phantom Thieves.
Yep. Looks like we're going to be having da-da-da-da. More sort of Etrian Odyssey-ish Persona. Good times. Crossover.
Excellent, excellent. You know, this is an interesting one because I think a lot of people expected that if there was a sequel to Persona Q, we would see it on a platform that isn't 3DS, even despite the Etrian Odyssey sort of focus. But this is absolutely going to be a 3DS game, so please look forward to it in 2018.
Excellent. Well, we have a short little burst of Senran Kagura news for you.
I see what you did there.
So, the first announcement that we have is Senran Kagura 7 Even, Girl's Happiness, which is a fall 2018 PS4 title.
Interesting, interesting.
We don't really know much else.
It just kind of looks like it's the next Senran Kagura mainline game.
Yeah, probably a little opai, or very, very much.
I was going to say a little opai.
Well, and speaking of Senran Kagura Burst, which we always used to, like, Freudian slip as Senran Kagura Bust because of all the...
Because Senran Kagura.
Yeah, of all the bustiness, is going to be remade as a 3D action remake for PS4 called Senran Kagura Bust Renewal. That's re-colon-newal.
Yeah.
Like, colon like the punctuation, not... Yeah.
All got it.
With these games, I think it needs to be specified.
Either way, obviously, you know, these are one of those games where, like, I kind of wish they weren't quite so objectifying.
Well, I noticed in one of these images on Silicon Era, there's an image of, like, a cantaloupe and some peaches. I'm assuming those are symbolic of something.
Yeah, you can... You could figure it out.
This is what the firmness feels like.
We also got the announcement of Peach Ball, Senran Kagura. This is an upcoming, quote-unquote, busty pinball game for Nintendo Switch. The pinball game will feature HD Rumble support that will allow players to feel the bounce and springiness you get when the ball touches certain body parts of the titular Shinobi girls. Please look forward to it.
You said titular.
Well... That was a complete coincidence. Unintentional.
Didn't we say it was only a matter of time before Senran Kagura got on the HD Rumble train?
I mean, Nintendo themselves said it in one of their presentations.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
We also have word here of a new Fate Grand Order fighting game. This one is Fate Grand Order Arcade. It is going to be a team battle arcade game. I have seen some people proposing that it's going to be more like a multiplayer Dissidia type experience. I've seen some people indicating that they thought it was going to be like a fighting game experience. So it's going to be interesting to see how this one turns out. Saiki, do you have any thoughts on Fate Grand Order Arcade?
Not particularly, but the Fate series is doing pretty well, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty big deal. I recently bought the Fate Extella game for Switch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I found a copy at my local Best Buy, and it was like, you know, I get the feeling this is going to be kind of a not super well produced game. I feel like it's going to end up being rare a few years from now, so I just picked it up.
I mean, at least the eShop is a thing now.
Well, yeah, that's exactly why, you know, for me, I like collecting games physically. I see a game I think is going to be rare, I pick it up. But for fans of the series, it will be forever easy to get a copy, and I think that's neat.
Indeed.
So last but not least on our news tip here, we have word that the upcoming Resident Evil Revelations pack that's going to be releasing on PS4 and Xbox One on August 29th is going to also be releasing on the Nintendo Switch in late 2017.
Ooh.
Yeah. You know, the Resident Evil Revelations games are pretty good, in my opinion.
Aren't they basically, like, more like Resident Evil than most Resident Evils are these days?
That is exactly
except
what
when
they
are. Resident Evil 7 tried to be spoopy, but then people weren't feeling it, and they just want, like, slightly problematic white saviors of zombies or something.
You're not talking about Resident Evil 7 when you say all that, but a lot of those things are things that
I'm
happen.
I'm saying that's part of the reason why...
people want that. I thought you said Capcom went with that. But no, Resident Evil 7, although it did technically underperform according to Capcom's most recent financials, is still over the, like, 4 million mark or something. Like, it's still definitely, like... a well-performing game. It's, it comes down to sort of like what we saw years back with Crystal Dynamics reboot of Tomb Raider, where they had moved 6 million units and Square Enix was still calling it a failure or a financial failure. Like, at some point, you need to set your expectations appropriately.
I have to wonder if at this point they were trying to turn attention away from the failure of Final Fantasy XIV.
Very likely, honestly.
And the poor reception of the 13 trilogy.
There really probably was some, like, international office drama about that. So I would believe it. You know, I've been thinking, because we're starting to get toward Christmas, Halloween. What game are we going to stream this year for Halloween?
Nothing with PSVR, please.
I was just going to say, how would you feel about taking turns doing Resident Evil 7 in PSVR?
That sounds terrifying.
All right, so maybe that's what we'll do.
Like, I'm going to be traumatized. Are you going to have a therapist on hand?
I won't have a therapist on hand, but I will have a barf bucket for you.
That doesn't make it more appealing.
It probably does for our listeners.
Careful, what happened last time when you were terrible to me? You got, like, physically slapped for it, so...
Yes, I did get physically slapped for it, which is why you deserve it all the more. You got me slapped.
You got yourself slapped, so, with that, let's go and...
Are you calling my assault my own fault?
So, we got some Culture Club.
All right, of course, Culture Club is a segment where you talk about news stories that maybe don't quite fit into our follow-ups or our main news segment, but are still worth noting, typically stories centered around the gaming culture and how these stories impact it. Slaggy, why don't you get the ball rolling?
Yeah, so... probably in news that shouldn't be too surprising, we have the announcement from Atlus and A1 Pictures that Persona 5 the Animation will be airing in Japan next year.
Excellent.
We don't know when, but 2018, so one of the four anime seasons, presumably.
Yeah, I'm going to expect it in the spring. I think the spring will be a good time for it.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe the problematic gay content will just be cut out. But probably not.
Fingers crossed. We also have word that, much like on the Wii U before it, Pokken Tournament DX on the Switch will be getting a controller made for it. This is, of course, pretty cool. It's very similar to the controller that you use on Pokken Tournament in the arcade. Something that's really neat is that the cable that is going to be on it is actually going to be about 10 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah, so that'll be a definite upgrade over the Wii U version. I'm actually kind of excited about this. It's sort of, like, fundamentally needless. Like, you don't really need...
If you have a pro controller, especially.
Right? You don't really need this special controller to play Pokken. And yet, it is kind of cool to have the exact same experience at home as in the arcade.
Yeah.
Are you going to pick one of these up, Slaggy?
I'll have to see what the price point is.
Well, Amazon has them up for pre-order already for $25.
Oh, that's not bad. I was expecting, like, $75.
Yeah, for $25, I'm kind of feeling like I'm going to order one right now.
Excellent. Well, we also have news that Monster Hunter Double Cross, I did it right this time, didn't I?
You sure did.
Is getting a demo on Nintendo Switch on August 10th. Of course, that's in Japan.
Yeah, so, you know, part of why this is a big Culture Club news story is that a lot of North American gamers are talking about, like, oh, be sure on the 10th to log into your Japanese account and download this demo and show Capcom that, like, there is demand for this content on the Switch in North America. You know, as it stands right now, it looks like we just aren't going to get Monster Hunter Double Cross at all, maybe. And a lot of us in the Monster Hunter fandom are pretty salty about that. I will definitely be taking part. I will definitely that day be, you know, reaching out to Capcom and tweeting at them. Oh, hey, this demo is great. I would love to play it in my native tongue at some point. Please consider us. And if you're listening to this, you like Monster Hunter, I recommend you join in the effort. Add your voice.
With Capcom, it's kind of a cap shoot.
You're not wrong. We also have word here of the recent news that several prominent Smash Bros. Melee tournament organizers have formed a competition committee to try and create like a standard set of Melee rules and regulations. And one of the things that has been really controversial about this rule set is that basically they're arguing that it, moving forward, Smash Bros. Melee tournaments should only allow people to use GameCube controllers. Of course, a lot of people online, a lot of people who go to tournaments actually use various different controllers. Some of them even like custom made. They're like these really weird like box style controllers that people make where that use arcade buttons, and the buttons are even keyed to like movement, so that you have like these weird arcade buttons for movement. But interestingly, you know, some people are very concerned because the GameCube controller is arguably unergonomic. I myself have always been a big fan of the GameCube controller. It is my favorite way to play Smash.
Like, those people play,
but people who are putting, you know, literally thousands, tens of thousands of hours into these games are concerned that over time it's creating, you know, some health problems for, you know, repetitive stress injury or what have you.
Huh.
And, you know, they say that as long as they're using a different controller that they're more comfortable with that still meets, you know, inspection requirements, that they should be allowed to use them at tournaments. And, so far, at least, the consortium of the competition committee has not backed down from this suggestion. So it's definitely something that is very interesting to a small number of us. Well, what are your thoughts, Slaggy?
That's interesting. I was going to say, have these people touched N64 controllers before? But, I mean, I guess if they're playing for thousands and thousands and thousands of hours, that makes sense. But I can't imagine playing Smash with anything but a GameCube controller. I don't mean necessarily Melee, but...
Well, and in case you've never seen what one of these boxes looks like, Slaggy, yeah, look
weird.
At my screen
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, I saw in the Kotaku article. It's
we'll link you to this Kotaku article over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org. It looks weird to me, but if it works for people, then I'm not going to judge them. It looks very weird.
All right, well, we also have word here of a Hearthstone streamer. And this is, to me, a really interesting news story. This is a Octavian Morrison, or as you might know him better, Kriparian. He streams his Hearthstone play. He streams doing the arena runs and stuff. And basically, he has discovered that there is an entire guild of players that watch his streams and coordinate their own queuing for arena matches with decks custom built just to take his decks down. Which obviously ruins his arena rating, prevents him from getting as good of rewards from the arena.
That's shitty.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of interesting, you know, this whole practice is called sniping, or, you know, stream sniping. And it's something that has gained a lot more attention in the last few months. Did we talk recently about stream sniping? I know Twitch has added some regulations against it. I feel like we talked about it then.
Probably. And I mean, I know when we were watching some PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds streams that, that someone stream sniped that and was being really shitty.
Yeah, you know, I think stream sniping is super jank. Like, if your whole thing is going to be like, I get my kicks from making someone that's playing games online look bad, like, that's not cool. I just don't think ruining other people's fun is ever cool.
Yeah.
We also have a news story here, and this is a little bit of a news story, but it's a little more Culture Club. The article is only incidental. We're really going to be focusing on what happened around the article, and that is Heather Alexandra, over at Kotaku did a look back article at Earthworm Jim. The piece is called Earthworm Jim's Mean-Spirited Satire Doesn't Hold Up. And basically, she talks about sort of some of the failures of the game design of Earthworm Jim, talks about actually some of the smart storytelling choices they made, which even still hold up. You know, they actually called attention to the damsel in distress trope pretty explicitly in this game, which even in, you know, 94 was something that got it a lot of positive coverage. The interesting thing here is that Doug Tennepel, the well-known and quite bigoted creator of Earthworm Jim, came for Heather Alexandra after she published this piece. He came for her on Twitter and unfortunately, you know, misgendered her intentionally repeatedly. Heather Alexandra is a trans woman. She is amazing. She's a good writer. And I actually thought that this piece, rather than coming off as a hit piece, certainly, you know, Doug Tennepel was not targeted in it in any way, shape, or form, I would say, or any meaningful way, shape, or form. I actually thought this was a really good story about a game's weaknesses and how those weaknesses have been exacerbated by the ravages of time as our standards have gone up in terms of our expectations regarding what games can and should be doing from a design perspective. And he basically just came for her on Twitter for talking, for criticizing a game he made, not even talking bad about it, for
a game he made,
genuinely criticizing it, like intelligently criticizing it.
Yeah. And not only that, game he made like 20 years ago.
And his choice was to come at her and misgender her and throw slurs at her and start ranting and rambling to his followers about how, you know, transgender identities aren't real. And, you know, if you're born a gender, you're always that gender. Science can't change it or whatever. And just spreading all kinds of hate. And it's been pretty gross. One positive, though, is that I actually think most of the gamers online have actually been on Heather's side on this one. So that's been really nice to see. You know, I have seen a few voices in on Twitter, obviously, unfortunately. You know, on Gaff, I saw a couple of people arguing for Doug Tennepel's read. Fortunately, those people all got banned super fast.
Oh, good.
And, you know, here's my thing on that, because I've seen a lot of people talk about, like, Gaff has become a place where people can't talk about things because people who disagree with the hive mind get banned. But real talk, I have never seen someone get banned for saying, I disagree with your opinions on a game. I have only seen people get banned for saying things like, I don't agree with this person's basic personhood. So maybe you just shouldn't say that. Like, if you're in a situation that calls someone's basic personhood into question, literally someone is saying that, like, oh, that identity isn't valid. Like, if you know you're in a space where, like, that kind of language isn't welcome, maybe just keep talking about games and don't talk about that shit then. Let the people who are talking about it and are defending just a hardworking games writer trying to elevate the medium of games journalism, maybe just let them keep doing that. It really pisses me off that all of these, like, ethics in games journalism types still come for people who are literally trying to do the best games journalism we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if it was never about games journalism in the first place. But those people are still fucking going. Ugh. I'm mad. Slaggy, I believe we have a couple of other news stories over in So Controversial. Do you want to take us there?
Sure. The first one is another bit of Kickstarter-related drama. This comes in an update about Unsung Story. You might be familiar with Unsung Story as being a strategy RPG that was going to be having a lot of input and creative facets from Yasumi Matsuno-san.
Yes!
So, of course, this was put on hold back in, actually, February of 2016. I didn't realize it was that long ago. However, the Kickstarter just got an update that said that Little Orbit is going to be developing the game at this point, and they're actually starting fresh and everything. And the controversy is that the portfolio of Little Orbit Games includes Kung Fu Panda, Showdown of Legendary Legends, Monster High, New Ghoul in School, Barbie and Her Sister's Puppy Rescue, and Adventure Time, Finn and Jake Investigations. So basically people are throwing shade at Little Orbit for their portfolio. I don't know. I mean, I think that it's kind of shitty to throw shade at someone just for their licensed, you know, their participation in licensed stuff. I mean, didn't WayForward do a lot of licensed stuff early on?
Yeah, and, you know, I actually am 120% with you here. WayForward is kind of the perfect example. You know, between getting passion projects like Shantae out, they were taking any work they could get. You know, we saw that with Double Helix Studios, who went on to make the revival of Killer Instinct.
Right.
A lot of times, some of these really great studios get their start doing licensed games. And to me, it's almost like if you have a track record of turning out all right licensed games, once you start getting into stuff like this, that's where you start to really shine.
And I mean, you know, Barbie and Her Sister's Puppy Rescue is really the unsung gem of the gaming world.
You know, I know nothing about that game. You're probably pulling my leg, but let's also be clear. I don't know the quality of any of those licensed games.
I don't
games,
either.
But if license holders continue to come to them to create games, they're probably doing pretty
well.
I mean,
we're talking like DreamWorks, Barbie, and I assume Monster High is owned by Mattel as well. And, like, you know, Cartoon Network, Adventure Time.
Yeah, if you're turning out poor games for those types of folks, they'll just go to another studio. They're not going to keep giving work to an underperforming studio.
Didn't WayForward do one of the Adventure Time games?
Yes, I believe so.
So I think it's shitty. I mean, I know this isn't really Slapkick opinion time, but I think it's shitty that people are not even giving this game a chance because they put out franchised games. People are disenfranchised by this.
You know, I get people who are upset about the Unsung Story fiasco, but to me, that Matthew Scott, the CEO of Little Orbit, came out and was like, you know, we're huge fans of Matsuno-san. We really want this game to exist. That's why we have intervened here, because to us, it is a passion project to save this game. I was a backer for Unsung Story. This is the first time I have felt positive about Unsung Story in a long time. Like, having someone step in and say, like, nope, you know what? We want this game to exist, and we're going to step in and make it happen. That's, like, the good thing.
People are like, nope, rather just not have it if it's going to be by Barbie and Her Sister's Puppy Rescue, people.
Yeah, people need some perspective.
I hope now that Barbie and Her Sister's Puppy Rescue is, like, really great for a Barbie game.
Yeah, that would be nice. We also have a news story here that Nintendo has confirmed that at some point in the month of August, which we are now currently in, there will be Super NES Classic Edition pre-orders in North America. This is, of course, controversial. You know, Walmart had accidentally put up their pre-orders in July. Everyone who pre-ordered ended up getting their pre-order canceled, unfortunately.
I never even got a cancellation email.
Slapkick and I both among them. I did. I even got a sorry note.
Oh, no, nothing for me. Nothing.
Well, that definitely sucks a lot.
Yeah, Walmart's terrible.
Either way, super excited that at some point I'll get to pre-order one of these things. I still really, really, really want to see how Star Fox 2 turns out. Like, yeah. That for me is the big deal why I have to have this. Because I've had people even ask me, like, I know for a fact you have cartridges of most of these things. And it's like, it's true, and, you know, I could play Star Fox 2 as a ROM, but, again, all of the ROMs we have online are unfinished copies. If Nintendo uses that ROM, it's going to be pretty weird. I have to assume they've done something to fix the game, or finalize the game, finish the game. And that's what has me super excited. Like, for all we know, this is a copy of the game that was finished back in 94, whatever, 90.
And just no one ever said anything.
And it just, well, I mean, it wouldn't even be a matter of whether anything was said or not. It would be a matter of whether anything leaked or not. And let's be real, the fact that we have any copies of Star Fox 2 on the internet yet at all is kind of a big deal because so little does leak from Nintendo.
True.
So, yeah, either way, my point, I need Star Fox 2, I need to see how it turned out, and I cannot wait, super excited, and at some point this month, pre-order is going to go up for Super NES Classic. I will definitely be tweeting that information out as soon as I can, and hopefully any of y'all out there that want this thing are also able to get one. Slaggy, are you still planning to get one, or are you so disfranchised? You're still planning to, then.
Yeah, but I mean, with my luck, it'll probably go up at, like, the worst time during the workday, and then, like, oops, they're gone.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. We also have word here that Intic Creates is no longer involved with the main development of Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night. This is obviously kind of a big deal due to the fact that, you know, this was a Kickstarter that in a lot of ways at the time, IntiCreates' name hadn't yet been dragged through the mud, which is what happened when Mighty No. 9 ended up releasing. A lot of people played the E3 build of the Bloodstained demo from last year, which was still IntiCreates' work, and a lot of us felt that it played perfectly. So anytime you see development shift over from one studio to another, especially where Kickstarter's involved, people get very concerned. And the Bloodstained fandom, because I guess we are already a fandom, we've all got a lot of strong opinions. So I will note, however, you know, IntiCreates is still developing the prequel game, which is going to be a 2D sprite-based Metroidvania, as I understand it. They're still doing that, and we actually know that IntiCreates can still do amazing sprite-based 2D game design, and that's really shown in multiple releases on the 3DS and Switch family. You know, the
Mighty Gunvolt
series, the Mighty Gunvolt series, Blaster Master Zero. So, you know, having those guys do that game is going to be super exciting. Interesting that Deco and Art Play are going to be the studios taking over the main Bloodstained game. Not quite sure what that's going to mean or what that's going to look like, but we haven't gotten a lot of information on Bloodstained in a while. I'm pretty concerned for the project, not in terms of, like, will it happen? I have absolute confidence that Igarashi is going to turn this game out, and I even believe it's going to be a good game. I'm just concerned we're going to end up looking at more delays because of this. Saiki, what are your thoughts?
I just think it would be funny if Konami swoops in now and puts out, like, a really good 2D Castlevania game, like actual Castlevania.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people are thinking or expecting or hoping that we will get a new Castlevania game sometime soon due to the Castlevania animation on Netflix. So we'll see there.
Yeah, we can get rid of that, like, stupid alternate Lords of Shadow story.
We do have the unfortunate news that Harmonix's Rock Band Blitz is being delisted from the PSN and Xbox Live stores. Aww. These are going to be delisted by August 28th. After that, there will be no way to continue playing Rock Band Blitz unless you already own it, as I understand. If you download it before then, of course, you can do the import to import the songs from Blitz into Rock Band 3 and 4. Every song from Rock Band Blitz is available as a separate download already, so at least we won't be losing any music from our libraries or the ability to buy those songs. But still, you know, a lot of us liked Rock Band Blitz a lot. A lot of us felt like it was a better Amplitude than the actual PS4 Amplitude game that got kickstarted.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah, it was a really great game, I felt. So definitely, definitely something to have on your radar. And last but definitely not least for this segment is word that GameStop will be open on Thanksgiving this year. As I'm sure you can imagine, this is very controversial because a lot of people want to spend the holiday with the damn family. Psyche, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, all this Black Friday, whatever they call it, Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. I mean, like, you know, this, like, creep into actually being on Thanksgiving has just been, like, stupid. And it's you know, the thing is that this is a complete 180 from what they were saying a couple years ago about, like, family comes first, we wouldn't want our employees to be working on Thanksgiving, so we'll be open Black Friday. So it's shitty, and I feel bad for the you know, I'm sure being a GameStop employee is probably shitty enough as it is. But especially with the way that people can be on these holiday sales and stuff, as far as consumers, my heart goes out to them.
Absolutely. But with all that having been said, we do have a smash hit this week. And Saiki, this was one that you linked to me. So would you like to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I'm not going to, like, summarize everything because, you know, the goal of our smash hits is that we want you to read them. But this is an article on Kotaku called The Hackers and Modders Behind the Next Official Sonic Game. And it's basically kind of a historical look at how Sonic Mania came to be. And, you know, all the pretty much all of the creative folks behind Sonic Mania are people who got their start in the Sonic fan game community. And, you know, basically
Taxman!
Yeah, I mean, this is basically looking like it's going to be the game that we wanted Sonic 4 to be. Let's just say that.
You hater. You're such a hater.
I mean, Sonic Mania is the game that we wanted Sonic 4 to be.
Sonic 4 is the game that I wanted Sonic 4 to be? Thanks.
So there's no significance in the fact that on the trailer for Sonic Mania, the animated one, that the little elevator is like 1, 2, 3 SKM.
Well, no, I mean, clearly that's sort of how they're positioning it. I'm just saying, I don't think that Sonic 4 was so bad we all need to pretend it didn't exist.
Anyway, I thought it was a really cool look at the history that a lot of people, especially if you're not Sonic freaks like Captain Spike and I are, that you might not be familiar with. I expect that we will probably take a look at kind of this journey ourselves once Sonic Mania has come out, because...
Yeah that will definitely
occur. I mean, this is a game that... I watched that stupid Sonic rave, whatever it was, when they had the announcement, and it was, like, really bad stream quality audio, and they had, like, an awkward dancing Sonic. All of that business when they were, when they were going to announce this, and Sonic, I'm almost called it Sonic Heroes.
Sonic Forces?
Sonic Forces, thank you. You know, the event where they announced those. I legit cried when they showed this. So, very high expectations here. But a great article.
Yeah, a really fantastic article. So, all right, well, with all of this having been said, it is time for us to move on to this discussion. So, this week we are going to be looking at Splatoon. You know, it's been noted we haven't been doing as many retrospectives this year. We are sort of moving our focus onto some more opinionated stuff for this year. But Splatoon is definitely one we really wanted to talk about. You know, Splatoon 2 released a week or two ago, and it has been super well-loved. It's been incredibly well-received. We just had the first Splatfest happen in Splatoon 2. I've been really impressed with it. I am completely consumed by this game, and I was really excited to talk about it. Slaggy, what have your experiences been with Splatoon? Let's start with Splatoon 1 and then move on to Splatoon 2. Then we'll talk about the history of the games themselves a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I first got on Splatoon 1 during, like, the original test Splatfires, whatever they call them, you know. So, you know, I was definitely on the Splatoon tip very early on. I was very interested when they announced it. And I thought the first Splatoon was a very solid game, a lot of fun. I mean, there's a lot... it's very clear why that game did as well as it did. I didn't spend too much time with it just because, unfortunately, you know, by the time that game came out, I wasn't really playing my Wii U as much anymore, to be honest. I think, you know, without, you know, dipping into what our discussion is, I think just the fact that Splatoon 2 is on Switch, and, you know, Switch allows you to so easily play wherever, I think that, you know, it's just a further testament of why the Switch is basically the ideal platform. Because, I mean, like, with Splatoon 1, I'd be limited to only playing at home, basically. I mean, I guess I could be, you know, on my gamepad. Did it even have off-TV play? I'm trying to remember.
I don't recall off the top of my head. I don't think so.
Yeah,
I would have played it more on that platform if it did.
Yeah, so, I mean, being kind of tethered to your TV really does affect your gaming habits.
Yeah, for me, needing to be tied to a TV is definitely a negative.
I mean, for example, you, me, and Sulker could not have played all the Splatoon that we did this weekend if we weren't able to do it all together, even if we, you know, were not able to get into Splatfests necessarily together.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, let's talk here then. Splatoon, obviously, a Nintendo game. I think a lot of us playing it right now, like, I think if you're listening to this show, there's a higher than likely chance that you are playing Splatoon 2
right now,
possibly as you're listening to this
right now,
almost certainly as we're recording it. But for those of you who don't know, the first Splatoon was a third-person shooter. It was developed and published by Nintendo for the Wii U, released worldwide in May of 2015. Game centers around characters who are known as Inklings, They have both humanoid and squid forms and can hide and swim through colored ink that has been sprayed on surfaces, including, you know, floors, walls, by using their weaponry, which can be gun-based, it can be brush-based, it can be literally a bucket you are throwing. It also features, you know, various types of grenades, super moves, sort of in the style of what you've probably come to expect from, like, franchises like Call of Duty or even Halo. So, Splatoon was originally developed by Nintendo's Entertainment Analysis and Development Division, which is itself kind of notable. You know, obviously, anything that's coming out of EAD is going to be a big deal. And this actually specifically came out of the Software Development Group 2. Software Development Group 2 is probably best known for, like, Animal Crossing games, like Wii Sports Club, Nintendo Land. I'm sorry, were you going to say something, Psyche?
I was going to say Wii Music, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, most of the Wii series games as we think of them.
I mean, but which, you know, definitely these... I mean, I did not think that Wii Music was a very big success. But, I mean, the rest of the games are, you know, definitely, I think, great. You know, Wii Sports and Animal Crossing. I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of all of those. They were involved in the development of the Miiverse, of course. It's just, you know, it's surprising because these are casual games. And so for them to tackle something like...
Basically the least casual genre of game other than MMOs.
Yeah, it was kind of a shock.
MMOs are interesting, though, because they basically exist in this, like, quantum super state of being both incredibly casual and incredibly hardcore. I would say shooters are, like, just hardcore.
Yeah.
Other than Splatoon. So, obviously, you know, Nintendo, anytime they make a new game and it's like a twist on an already existent genre, you know, that's almost always a recipe for success. I think we've all read about how Pikmin was like Nintendo's take on, like, real-time strategy. It's just always interesting. So the Nintendo take on shooters, it kind of originated as just like a multiplayer competitive ink-based territory control game. You know, it didn't have the squids, it didn't have the ability to, like, swim through ink or whatever.
So it was basically a Nickelodeon game show from the 90s.
Well, pretty almost exactly, yes. Shintaro Sato-san was actually the one who sort of came up with that concept. And so, you know, they're developing it, it's still, like, mid-2013, and, you know, he's made this 4v4 ink-based territory control game, and, you know, management actually saw the prototype and was like, oh yeah, this should be a full game, like, this is already fun. But, you know, they felt the need to, like, expand the concepts, and the first thing that really came up with that was the ability to hide in ink. And Shigeru Miyamoto-san, who actually gets a lot of hate for not being super forward-thinking in the modern age of game design.
And for upending the tea table constantly.
Well, yes. He basically told the team that he felt that the game was not presently appealing, that it was lacking, like, a simple, fun mechanic that would bring everything together. And that's sort of what drew the dev team to think about, like, well, how can we tie in, you know, hiding in the ink, spreading the ink? And it actually really turns out that I think one of the big things is really the ability to swim in the ink and even swim up walls in the ink, which really turns your swimming ability into something vital and not just optional. Like, you really need to master switching into your squid form and swimming through your ink, not just to refill your ink jets, but for the sake of real, like, motion and momentum. And it's like, you're looking over here. Do you have something to add?
Oh, no, just that, you know, I think that was one of the first, well, not first, but, you know, like, that decision, that and the focus on, you know, that you're trying to cover the territory rather than just pew-pew, get as many headshots as you can, is what really where the brilliance of this game comes from. So, like, I think that moment in development where they, you know, like, okay, well, you know, adding the swimming in, going up the walls, and really, you know, going from there, like, that really, I think, is what... I mean, I feel that if it had just been, like, a Nickelodeon GAC splat game, it still would have been fun, but I don't think it would have been the success that it has been.
Well, and so, you know, it's interesting you say that, because one of the other big parts of the success of Splatoon
is Squid Kids.
Well, exactly, you know.
People love Inklings.
Initially, the art director of the team was going through a lot of different ideas for the player character. There's some discussion on having it be, like, various kinds of animals or, like, robots. I think they even had almost, like, macho men as one of their ideas for a while, almost, like, super, like, pro wrestlers running around
that with ink
guns. There was a time where they tried to make it through as, like, a Mario game, but the co-directors actually really wanted, like, playable squid. Like, for whatever reason, they were, like, dead-eye on, like, squid.
And I also believe that they wanted it to be a success on its own merit, not just because people were like, oh, it's a Mario game, it's a Mario spinoff, I'm going to buy that because it's Mario.
That is absolutely correct. So, you know, ultimately they ended up bringing this together, and something else really remarkable that the game... I think we all kind of know, but we don't necessarily explicitly talk about, is that fashion and style was really brought to the forefront of the game as well. You know, all of your power-ups in the game are themed around, like, getting new fashion accessories, new shirts, new shoes, new, like, glasses or headwear.
It's very much like the kind of skater culture of the 90s, you know, like, getting the skate shoes and the...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in addition to that, you know, it's also all done with, like, stats and stuff similar to what you would see out of, like, The World Ends With You, very much themed around an analog of that same kind of, like, Shibuya street
urban
youth culture,
yeah,
that is, you know, so big in Japan.
And, of course, like, you know, Jet Set Radio is the other artistic kind of cousin, I guess you could say.
Oh, absolutely. Also very much a Shibuya youth culture game. That game almost specifically, like, I believe takes place in Shibuya. So, you know, there's also a real focus on, like, the presentation, on the music in particular, you know, like, a lot of very fresh music, the kind of stuff you actually would probably have never, ever have expected to come out of Nintendo musically. Interestingly, the music in Splatoon done by Toru Minagishi-san, who you might be familiar with for his work actually on a lot of the Zelda games. But did the composition for
Which
Splatoon...
Which is funny because it's, like, nothing like Zelda at all.
Right? I mean, you look at Minagishi-san's other work, you're looking at stuff like Mario Kart 7, Steel Diver, did some work for Smash Bros. 4, did some work on Super Mario 3D World, and then it's like Twilight Princess, Phantom Hourglass, Spirit Tracks,
right. Well,
Wind Waker, Majora's
Mask. Knowing
that
he did music for Mario Kart 7 actually doesn't surprise me, because those Mario Kart tunes are always, you know, pretty rockin'.
Well, yeah, and in fact, Mario Kart 7 and 8 in particular, both just really tremendous music that also, I think, took things in kind of a new direction musically for the
series.
Yeah,
especially like Mario Kart 8, which was like... I mean, you kind of have that going on with Splatoon 2, you know, very, like, kind of, like...
hip.
Yeah, like, very 90s kind of alt-rock guitars, and it just, like, all of it, like, atmospherically just makes something really special and fun and charming.
Absolutely. So, you know, the first Splatoon, super well-received when it was even just revealed. Like, people who were playing the initial demos are just, like, blown away, and super living for all of the new gameplay ideas that it brought to the sort of shooter space. Obviously,
right.
Loving the fact that it was an all-new IP. Upon release, it was very well-received and actually ended up as an 81 on Metacritic, which...
That's pretty good.
Yeah, like, people literally, like, at other studios get bonuses for releasing games that score that high, so got a lot of negative feedback, however, for some of the more Nintendo aspects of its online presentation.
Yeah.
You know, at launch, low number of maps, low number of modes, no voice chat, so, you know, got a lot of negativity, but something that really happened with Splatoon, and I think this was the first Nintendo game that really embraced this idea, is that there was regularly new content updates for free, you know, live events happening every couple of weeks with the Splatfests, and just so mm-hmm. we're clear, because, you know, we're talking about Splatfests, we brought that term up a couple of times already today. For those of you who don't know, a Splatfest is basically this in-game event where you pick a side, you pick one of two opposing sides. Sometimes it'll pop up, it'll be like Autobots versus Megatron or Decepticons.
Was that really a Splatfest?
Yes, that was a licensed Splatfest. They did a couple of licensed ones, and that was one of them from Splatoon 1.
That's funny.
basically everyone picks a side, and then in all of your online games for like a set period of time, typically it's just like a 24-hour window where you play online, and your wins against the opposing team are counted toward an overall tally that's being kept of like, oh, my wins right now are contributing to the Decepticon wins.
Justice for Team Ketchup.
Right? And at the end of the time period, you know, the wins are tallied, and basically you see which side won. It's a lot of fun. It's a great community event. And over time, in fact, IGN ended up going back and re-reviewing the game. They initially, IGN had given the game like a 7.9.
7.9 out of 10, too much ink.
Right? They actually went back after some of this post-release support and went back and re-reviewed it and gave it an 8.6. You know, new maps were coming out fairly regularly, new weapons every few weeks. And overall, it turned out that because of the way the game it was supported after release and on the Wii U, which was itself a feat, really turned out to be something special. So that kind of brings us to today. Well, actually, I guess there's one more thing to note. Splatoon sold ridiculously well. And that's true everywhere to some degree. Splatoon was a very successful game. But more than anywhere else, Splatoon was an enormous success in Japan.
Yeah.
It was the most successful new IP in Japan across all platforms since Wii Sports.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. So, you know, this game in Japan alone selling millions of units on the Wii U of all things. It is, of course, no surprise that one of the first announcements that we got for the Nintendo Switch was Splatoon 2.
Now,
on that original Nintendo Switch reveal event, in fact, Splatoon 2 was featured.
Yep.
You were going to say?
I was going to say, a lot of people were saying, like, even though, like, you know, they love Splatoon and they're like, oh, I'm still going to pick it up, I felt like a lot of people said too soon. Do you think that 2 years after the original, what was it, 2015 was the original Splatoon?
Well, yeah, right? It was a 2015 game.
Yeah, so do you think that 2 years after a release is too soon? I guess we can look to Ubisoft and Assassin's Creed and say is a yearly release of a franchise too soon? I did not think that this was too soon. Do you think that this was too soon?
So initially, when we saw Splatoon 2 at that reveal event, and it wasn't yet called Splatoon 2, a lot of us thought it was going to be Splatoon DX, and just, you know, Splatoon 1 with some new features, more offline play options, etc., etc. And at the time, I was like, oh, a deluxe version of Splatoon, that's cool. When they did confirm it was Splatoon 2, I actually did have some minor reservation. You know, like just, hey, it kind of seems a little anemic with new content to be a full-fledged sequel. But especially now that I've played the game, I absolutely feel that it's a sequel. I feel like a lot of the cool ideas from the first game have been expanded on. You look at stuff like Salmon Run, which is like this horde mode. And that, it's tremendous fun to play. I do think that the game feels like a sequel, especially like you look at the Splatfest we had, where, you know, the whole game world changed during the Splatfest event. And I know some stuff
like
that.
Rave.
Some stuff like that did happen on the old game, but I felt like this was like the next level step for that kind of content. And I actually do, now that I've spent real time with it, I've already put in an absurd number of hours into Splatoon 2. I actually do think that it is absolutely deserving of that 2 in its name.
Yeah, I've seen some people on my friends list who've already put in possibly 70 to 80 hours.
Holy mackerel. I mean, I've surpassed the 20-hour mark, and this game only came out July 21st, so it's only been a couple weeks.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I get it. It is super fun. If I had that kind of free time, I would probably be one of those people. I just don't.
Yeah.
You know, so the game ended up, it released July 21st. Sales have been really fantastic. As far as I know, it's actually tracking ahead of the first Splatoon, which a lot of people did not expect. Debuted at number 2 on the UK software sales charts its launch week, behind only Crash Bandicoot and Sane Trilogy. That's actually a big deal because in the UK, Nintendo titles typically suffer.
Mm.
On the UK sales charts, Nintendo games very rarely rank that high.
Also, the UK seems to love, like, Crash Bandicoot and their mascot platformers.
Yeah. So it actually ended up having a 59% better sales week than Splatoon in the UK, and is the third biggest launch of a Switch game in the UK.
Probably only behind Mario Kart 8 DX and Breath of the Wild, I would guess.
Yeah, I would guess that too, which should tell you where Splatoon exists, even in just its second game in the franchise.
Poor arms.
Right? Well, hey, you know, don't worry about arms. It's past the million mark, so it's safe to say that arms did fine for itself, whether it has legs or not.
Well, it has arms.
But I think, you know, it was inevitable that releasing Splatoon 2 a month later was going to chop those legs out from under arms. I don't think Nintendo's going to be surprised by this. I am sure at this point that there will be an Arms 2 someday. And hopefully until then, we kept getting, you know, post-launch support.
Yeah, we can only hope that Arms will have a similar success story and that Arms 2 will really build on Arms 1. But, I mean, this isn't Arms. Let's get back to talking about tentacles.
Well, in Japan,
not there.
In Japan, Splatoon 2 has, in its first 2 days of release, sold over 500,000 units. And something that needs to be kept in mind is that the Switch itself in Japan is still hard to get.
Oh yeah, we saw like those pictures of Toys R Us's. We even talked about that, right?
Yeah, yeah. With, you know, hundreds to thousands of people lined up for hopes to get a Switch.
Yeah, just for the chance of the lottery to get a Switch. So.
Yeah, so it definitely things are looking good for Splatoon. We know, of course, that Splatoon 2 is going to be regularly updated with new content for free after launch. The regular updates, you know, new maps, new weapons, will be going for at least a year. And Splatfests will be going for at least 2 years. This has, of course, led a lot of people to speculation that we may get a Splatoon 3 on the Switch someday.
Or the Switch 2.
Or the Switch 2. I mean, I think a third Splatoon game is inevitable. I'm just wondering if we will see Nintendo stick to their, you know, one game in a franchise per platform rule that they've typically followed. Or, since the Switch is both a home console and a handheld console, we won't see a lot of franchises go to a 2 or 3 iteration plan. And true. A lot of people are using Splatoon as sort of, now that we know what the post-support plan looks like, a lot of people using that as sort of like the metric to start guessing around. So
yeah.
Definitely some interesting stuff to think about there if you're really into the inside baseball of it all, so to speak. So I think that's about it for sort of the big talk around Splatoon. You know, it does need to be said, obviously, you can get Splatoon Amiibo. The Splatoon Amiibo are super well loved. Already, you know, the world of Nintendo toys have Splatoon characters among the lineup. They have done live shows for Splatoon music in Japan. One of the big things that the Splatoon franchise really includes in its depiction of, like, hip Shibuya street culture is also, like, a focus on, like, idol personalities. The first game, of course, had Callie and Marie, who were they squid also, or were they octopi?
I mean, kind of the same thing, right? I mean...
No, I have actually been told that they are very different by people on the internet.
Well, let me see that octo. Hold it.
Well, you know, they are known as the Squid Sisters, which I probably should have just clocked in the first place. But, yeah, and then the new games have, what is it?
Pearl and Marina.
And these characters are also super well-loved. You know, in the games, they are represented as, like, idol performers.
Well, Marina's IRL. A DJ.
IRL, you know, obviously there's already, like, merch and shirts and reams of fan art. So it's, you know, just so much personality at play here. All in all, Saggy, where are you at on Splatoon? What are you thinking? How are you enjoying it? Do you anticipate playing a lot more of it? Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think the thing that there's two things that make Splatoon have a lot of replayability. One of it is that focus on the fashion and the upgrades and being like, oh, even if you, like, don't really care about the abilities, you're like, oh, well, I want this NES zapper and these super cool sunglasses and kicks because they look really cool. Like, I mean, if that's how you want to play it, you can. But also just the fact that, like, you know, I'm not a big fan of shooters typically because, you know, and I guess the thing that you have to realize if you are new to first-person or third-person shooters is that you're going to die a lot. Like, that's the thing that took me a long time to get over. I'm like, oh, I'm dying. I mean, I guess that's kind of an inevitability. But, like, there's very little to get upset about with Splatoon because, you know, the match is over in 3 minutes. And even, like, you know, if you lose, like, it's like you still had fun. And like I said, the focus on trying to cover the stage with as much ink as you can, rather than just try to, you know, go and get as many kills, I think really switches the focus of it. And so it just makes it a lot more fun to be like, oh, man, you know, like, that team, like, covered way more ink than be like, oh, I got teabagged and sniped, like, the entire time and it wasn't fun. It softens the blow of losing, which, I mean, you know, is a very, I feel like, intentional design point. So,
yeah,
they knocked it out of the park with Splatoon 1, even though I didn't spend a lot of time. I'm making up for it with Splatoon 2 and looking forward to continuing to do Splatfests and all that sort of thing.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, then let's wrap this up and move things forward here. We're going to start wrapping up by talking about what's up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
So my big what's up for this week is easily Splatoon 2. It has taken up the vast majority of my gaming time since the last time we've recorded here. I'm really digging it. You know, I ended up a team catch-up on the catch-up versus Mayo Splatfest this past weekend. Super sucks, of course, that team catch-up lost, but really had a super blast getting to catch-up king, getting gear, getting upgrades for my other gear through using the shells that I got from that. Just having an absolute blast really digging into Splatoon 2. To a degree, at this point, I think I have surpassed where I was in Splatoon 1 in terms of skill and even time investment. I think I wrapped up the first Splatoon at about the 20-hour mark, and I have surpassed that on Splatoon 2 already. So
that's great.
Yeah, very, very excited about it. I have also been playing a little bit of Final Fantasy 14, just still working on the main story quests, just wrapped up the Heavensward stuff, so about to start digging into Stormblood after I do a few patch quests.
You're in for a treat.
Yeah, I'm super excited. What about you, Slaggy? What have you been playing?
Well, pretty much the same, but in different proportions. I've mostly been playing Final Fantasy XIV Stormblood. I finished the main scenario, and like, basically, you know, right now, since there's no patch quests, I'm, you know, just, I actually just got all of the entry-level, like, good gear, the Tombstones of Creation, or the whatever they're called. I think they're Tombstones, right? Whatever. Anyway. So, you know, I've basically geared up as much as I can on my Dark Knight without going into the Omega Raid, which is cool. So, I mean, like, I can, like, for now, I kind of see that tapering off a little bit, just because, you know, I finished the main story quest. It's really good. I think that Final Fantasy XIV is, like, not even secretly, I think it's, like, openly the best Final Fantasy game of the franchise. Honestly, like, the story is really good.
Yeah, and you skipped the first two stories the game told.
I played through the main part of the story quest of one.
No, my point here wasn't to shade you. It was to say you should watch, like, the movie versions that you can access, because I think it's
right,
worthwhile. They tell great stories.
I do regret skipping over the Heavensward story content, because I know that was really well liked by a lot of people.
Incredible.
But Stormblood content is amazing. I can't wait for you to see some of the dungeons and quests and primals and stuff. I'm so excited. The other thing is obviously Splatoon 2. I just because of paycheck reasons and such, wasn't able to pick it up until just last week. But you know, definitely making up for lost time. Already like level 7. I just got it on Friday, actually, so, you know, already put in quite a bit of time just since getting in on Friday, so really looking forward to probably spending more time with that now that I don't have as much to do in Final Fantasy XIV for the time being.
Excellent.
All right, that being said, we're going to go over to our social links, where we asked this week with the release of Splatoon 2, we're looking at the new Nintendo IP that has made a splat with gamers worldwide. Are you a fan? Over on Facebook, Jason L., also known as Seawolf Jason, said, I'm a fan, but there's a severe lack of multiplayer on one console, which defeats a bit of the theme of Switch. I can understand that there is no, you know, split-screen multiplayer, which I understand it, but I know for some people that's kind of a selling point. Mike I saying, I'm a fan since the first game. One of my favorite games on the Wii U, and the sequel is even better, even if it fails in some aspects. Over on Twitter, we have Amiibo 69 saying, I like the first, but I didn't play it too much. I'm just not a competitive person, but I like the idea of the co-op matches in the second one. We have Shaden. I always mess up his name. Shad Leland, also known as Shane from Ranger Podcast, saying, it's the reason to own a Switch right now. No other game is nearly as good. Flocko Jones saying, huge fan. The first one was one of my all-time favorite games. The sequel may surpass it. Sky, better known as Rob Roberts, replying to Shane's tweet with a gif of Link looking really angry and shrugging like, I'm assuming, I think it's Twilight Princess Link, but I assume that it's like, hey, what about Breath of the Wild? Which, agreed. I mean, Breath of the Wild is amazing, game of the year, so good, but Splatoon 2 is also really good. We have Gym Leader Derek saying, never touched the first one, but I'm completely obsessed with 2. Leave it to Nintendo to get me hooked on a shooter for the first time. Octopus emoji. Definitely, I can relate to that with having not touched the first one quite a lot. And we actually got to play a little bit with Gym Leader Derek on Splatfest.
Yeah, I've actually played with, I think, pretty much everyone that we've already talked about here. I think I've played with all of these people at least once.
I correct myself. It wasn't during Splatfest because it's kind of hard unless you get a room. But we did get in some matches post-Splatfest. And last but not least, we have Your Enzyme saying, nope, LOL, and then following up with, honestly, I'd probably enjoy it if I had played it. Oh, Your Enzyme, never change. In non-Splatoon news or social medias, we have That Retro Code replying, actually retweeting our Evo 2017 episode, saying, love this podcast and all the hard work that goes into it. Aw, thank you. And thank you to everyone who listens and responds. We love your feedback. We love your iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We like your Facebook likes, and we effing love Twitter.
We do. We effing love Twitter.
You can mail us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
And you can visit us at gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
But you can also find us at the
Voice of Geeks Network over at VogNetwork.com, where you can hear us and such other delightful, fantastic shows as Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO, or Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom we steal so many of our cues. You can also hear myself and Shane Alenko talk about the current season of the Power Rangers meta series and the current season of the Super Sentai meta series, upon which it's based out of Japan, over on Ranger Pridecast. As far as shows that aren't on VOG, I'd like to point you in the direction of the Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin, as well as X Nation, awesome, their sister show, which is an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. You should also check out Reading is Fundamental, which is Slagkick's show about the current season of RuPaul's Drag Race. What do you mean there isn't a current season? It must be on hiatus. That's featuring myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness. We have a great time, and I can't wait for it to pick back up. Slaggy, take us a place.
I'm going to take you to a game bar. Game Bar is the gay video game prairie home companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch, along with Video Game Realness, serving up a dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, the Magical Boys podcast, a pop culture podcast from a queer perspective, formerly known as the Joystick Jockeys, now talking about all things pop culture, and Nintendo Fun Club, our allies over there, which is your place for platformers, positivity, and pop punk. I'd like to direct you to our sister shows, Anime Buoy, your port of call for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be, and Stabcast, which is the short form of Same Type Attack Bonus podcast, your twice monthly look at the deeper worlds of Pokemon that we do with Trainer Sulker. Also, our wonderful theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated, which is the project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They unfortunately closed their doors quite a while back at this point, but we'll forever be out in the Great Fairy Fountain pouring out a 4E with our girl, the Great Fairy.
All right, that about wraps it up this lovely Sunday evening. Thank all y'all out there in Internet Radio Land for listening. I hope you've had half as much fun hearing us speak as we have had speaking to all of you tonight. We'll be back at you in another week or two, but until then, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And I'm one fiery squid kid, so Charizard speaks to me.
Don't get cooked. Stay off the hook.
Yeah, one of the Splatfests was actually Pokemon Red versus Pokemon Blue.
I was going to say Team Aqua and Team Magma would be a good one if they didn't do that.
Well, who knows? Maybe they'll announce another set of Pokemon remakes and we'll get that.
Oh, boy. It's Splat Tim. He does it. Are you guys splatting right in front of my salad?
Ha!